This is Resonance FM, and it is International Women's Day. This is part of an entire day of programming and discussion and debates around women's issues globally, whether that's artistic and cultural or it's about women's rights all over the world. But this particular slot, we have just 1 hour to talk about activism and change and hopefully talk in a positive way about how we can and how we are changing the world. This is, of course, part of a centuries-long women's movement towards emancipation and freedom and justice. Emancipation principally from violence, from exploitation, from the exploitation of our labour. But it's also about how we're represented in general life, in the arts and the media and in culture. I'm Badisha, and I've got three brilliant guests with me. Closest to me right now is Kira Cochrane, who's the features writer at The Guardian and is also a novelist, but was the Women's Pages editor for, I think it was 4 years, wasn't it?
5 years, yeah.
5 years. I'm also joined by Jess McCabe, who is the editor of the F Word website, which currently gets about 100,000 hits every week. Am I right in saying that?
It's actually about 200,000 unique hits every month. So
that's brilliant. Yeah. It's one of the major feminist news and articles resources, not only in this country, but also internationally. And as we've discussed many times, frequently gets ripped off by the mainstream press for its stories, because you are on stories about women globally, often before news wires and mainstream newspapers are. Furthest away from me, but not ideologically, is Vicky Simister, who I know because you are the founder of the LASH, the London Anti-Street Harassment Campaign, but in fact you're also a political activist and a long-time activist, aren't you?
That's right, yes.
Tell me a little bit about the Anti-Street Harassment Campaign. I'm interested in this because whenever on our newspapers someone writes about this issue, which is the on-street harassment of women, there is a disproportionately huge response. Hundreds and hundreds of women write in, and you're focusing some of that energy, aren't you?
That's right. I think that, well, the reason I started the campaign was that it was so intrinsic in every woman's daily and weekly life that we actually didn't have a name for it or do anything about it. We just accepted it. When I'd go to the pub on the way, I kind of would expect on a dark, you know, night when people had a few drinks to experience some sort of harassment, some bloke following me down the street. And I got so frustrated that I thought I need to put something out here and start, you know, actually raising awareness. And I think lots of women who previously had thought, I just have to accept it or maybe even take it as a compliment, really resonated with them. So there's been a fantastic response from women and from men alike, who many of whom had no idea that it actually happens, because of course the women who are targeted are always kind of vulnerable and on their own and not seen to be protected by a man or owned by a man as they walk down the street.
It's strange how incredibly common it is, and I think that something which often happens in activism of all kinds is that you don't realise that what commonly happens to you must actually commonly be happening to lots of people. You think it's something to do with you until you actually kind of open it up and you actually speak to other people about it.
Yeah, and strangely enough, a lot of women who do contact me, you know, with their stories, of which there are many and some of which are horrific, they often... You just said something there that kind of struck me. They feel that it must be something to do with them. So they say things like, I was walking down the street, by the way, I wasn't dressed promiscuously. And we've actually kind of become this kind of generation of women who think that we somehow deserve it. You know, we deserve to be harassed or perhaps even raped at the far end of the scale based on our appearance and how we dress and how we walk and where we are at night. So that's an attitude that I really want to see changed.
In an article I once wrote about harassment, I got there were sort of hundreds of comments, all of varying degrees of traumatic and disturbing quality. The most disturbing one was a woman who said that a guy in a bar had sort of made a pass at her, and she politely rebutted him. And then later in the evening, he actually stubbed a cigarette out on her hand and said, "That's something for you to remember me by," which was utterly shocking. And she wrote to me privately, and I said, "Look, you have to write this on a public website, because you just can't keep it to yourself. You know, if this person has done this to you, he's done it to other people. It's not some unique thing." The funniest one was a lady who was walking down the street, and a man came up behind her and said, "Nice lady, nice bottom," and she she described raising her umbrella up above her hand, and it was a novelty umbrella with a duck, a duck's head at the end, and sort of like Miss Piggy, she went, hi-ya! And she hit him on the head with the duck end of the umbrella. And he was so frightened he ran away, and she chased him with the duck umbrella sort of held aloft. So, you know, I'm not saying it's funny, of course, but...
It does make you sort of think that you should always carry a duck umbrella, though.
It really... I mean, just specifically that it was a duck umbrella just makes me happy. And the fact that
you
he ran away...
You can see how it would be painful.
Answering back... I mean, the serious thing to say is that for every woman I spoke to who said that they'd actually answered back, you feel better when you do. But I've hogged Vicky's time a little. I have to move on to Jess, who's sitting there really patiently. I have to say that the F Word website is the thing I log on to first thing in the morning. There are two things. I Google Guardian plus women, which brings up the women's pages of the newspaper, and I look for news on your site. Does it surprise you that it's still the case that anything about women is underreported in traditional news outlets?
I'm not sure I could say it genuinely surprises me. I'm so used to it at this stage.
We're such hardened cynics by
yes.
now that it, yeah.
And although the women's pages are wonderful in The Guardian, there's always the same issue that it ends up in the style and lifestyle section, and it's not in the main pages of the newspaper. So that's what our site is really there to do, to centre these issues and to provide a place where people can discuss their own personal experiences and the news stories and, you know, studies that have been done and so on and so on. So that's, you know, that's why the site was set up 10 years ago, actually. It's our 10-year birthday party this weekend coming.
Do you want to advertise that? Because it is in London.
It is. You can look on our website for details of where to go and how to get a ticket for it. But yes, it is 10 years. It's pretty amazing. I've been editor for 4 years. It was set up by Catherine Redfern in a time when there was no feminist blogs. Catherine set it up because she looked online for UK feminism and she found nothing except for some academic pages from, I guess, women's studies courses.
What effect do you think that the existence of the site has had? To my mind, as a journalist, it's had a huge effect because it's, of course, a way of focusing news, focusing interest and claiming space in the internet, which is still in the throes of this kind of revolution where nobody quite yet knows how to stake a claim on it. And traditional newspapers have, of course, done very well on it. But the F Word is doing something very special. And its popularity is a testament to the fact that you're not getting this kind of information anywhere else.
Yes, and I think that it is reaching people who are all across the country and in places where there's perhaps still not feminist groups and feminist activism going on. We still get countless emails in all the time. I don't know anyone personally who's a feminist. Your site is a lifeline for me. I just came across it and it's amazing. It's opened my eyes that other people think the same way that I do. And that is a big role for the site, as well as also because anyone can submit an article or a blog post to the site. So that's a big thing as well, because there are still major barriers for an ordinary person who was wanting to write about their experiences in the mainstream media. But we will cover and run stories about an individual person's experience of street harassment or rape, or these stories which are very difficult to get into the newspapers. It's not a news story, so that's a massive part of the role of the site as well.
It's a bit shocking what Jess says, isn't it, Kira, that actually violence against women is so common that it doesn't constitute news. I mean, it has to be really unbelievably brutal for it to make it into newspapers.
It is shocking, and it's really... It was one of the things that was really difficult on the women's pages, is that, you know, it's estimated that I think there are 47,000 rapes in the UK every year. When you have that sort of number, the individual case doesn't become a story, and so you're looking for ways to cover that which sort of underline the enormity of it, but also hopefully look at ways that it might be possible to at least address that culture. So, you know, for me, one of the major concerns when I was women's editor and as a writer on women's issues now was always the rape conviction rate in this country, which stands at 6.5% in England and Wales of all rapes which are reported to police.
Which are themselves a tiny proportion of,
yeah,
of
I mean,
the
it's
rapes
thought
that happen.
It's sort of, I think Vera Baird, the barrister and former MP, said that it was thought to be about 10 to 20% of all rapes are reported. So when you look at those sort of figures, as an editor, what you want to do is find a way to bring the enormity of those stories to an audience and also, ideally, to make them active and make them respond to them and think of ways to address that issue. You know, the rape conviction rate is 6.5% in England and Wales. I think it's only about 3.5% in Scotland. I mean, it's an absolute national scandal. But how do we address it? I think one of the greatest ways to address it is the way that Vicky is addressing it at the moment, which is that she's taking on a part of rape culture, because it is a part of rape culture, that sort of street harassment. And she's looking at that and saying, let's pinpoint this. Let's pinpoint this first step on the spectrum. Recognise that it's something that is actually a means of control of women. And let's speak out about it. Let's make it a political issue and going to the politicians and actually getting on their agendas and hopefully making legal changes.
Let's talk a bit more about that, Vicky, because one of the things I admire about your campaign is that it's not, although I am not against online activism, what you're doing is sticking your head above the parapet and going to the people who really can change policy and culture on this. And that takes enormous guts. How did you go about doing that?
I started out, I guess, just representing myself, and I wrote a letter to my own MP, who was Diane Abbott, who's the Labour MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington. And she is quite, I guess, friendly with women's issues, put it that way. She's at least aware, and she supports quite a lot of rape crisis support in her constituency. So she immediately put her name to the campaign. And that's when as I was formalising the campaign, that's when I think I realised actually politicians are where we're going to, you know, actually start to make some change. I contacted Una King, who was running for mayor. Unfortunately, she's been knocked out of the bidding at the moment. But I contacted her and got her to write an actual policy as to how to deal with street harassment into her campaign manifesto, and that was a world first for street harassment. And I used that, I guess, as leverage to get Ken Livingstone on board. I also let him know that I'd be going on the radio the following night, and would he like to have any comments before I go on that on the show? That probably helped influence it a little bit as well. But it's great to have people like him on board, and obviously now I want to know what Boris has to say about this, because it's happening in London. There's quite a lot of work that has to go into it, though, in order to get politicians to take notice. You need to get names, you need to get facts and figures. So right now I'm actually conducting a survey, which you can find on our website, ashcampaign.org, where I want to map out exactly where in London this harassment happens, to what extent. So, you know, you can click what's happened. Have you been wolf whistled? Have you been groped? You know, a huge list, unfortunately, of different ways to be harassed. Where it happened, you know, how you feel. Did you report it to police? And when I kind of get to my kind of, it's about 1,000 people I really need to make a real formal survey. I'm going to take that to, I'm going to map it out and list it in, you know, order of severity, and, you know, going to find the most harassed boroughs in London and go to those MPs and local councillors and say, right, what are you going to do about this? But it does take you know, the involvement of women in general. You know, people need to get on board and actually kind of sign up and say, yeah, this does happen to me, and we need to give a voice to it, and then hopefully the politicians will listen to us and give us the voice.
What would you then like to happen? Because it's one of the sayings of the contemporary women's movement that although the laws for equality, for example, are in place, that doesn't mean to say that there isn't a pay gap or all sorts of issues around equality. It may well be that an awareness of things like harassment is written into legislation, but it then has to be enforced, and there has to be a kind of a general social understanding of the wrongness of this. I mean, I've always maintained that perpetrators, of course, know it's wrong, and that's part of the the joke and the enjoyment for them of it, that there is no question that the woman who's being harassed is not a participant, is not consenting, is not enjoying it. But even if there was a law against it, it wouldn't necessarily stop harassment unless there was much more behind it.
Well, I think exactly you're right, and it can seem quite intimidating when you look at that as an issue, especially when it's something like street harassment, which can be quite fuzzy and kind of a grey area as to what actually it, you know, constitutes it. But I think that first, if we don't have laws and if we don't have authorities backing it up, then we're never going to get anywhere. It does need to be a societal change. It needs to be socially unacceptable. So at least, you know, when it happens to you on the street, strangers don't kind of grin to themselves or turn the other cheek. But it also needs, we need to have the police there as a backup to reinforce that it's not correct. And I knew from my own experience, the experience that made me start this campaign was that when I was harassed for 20 minutes on a dark street by a car of men and called the police because I'd been physically assaulted and throttled in a tube station, they told me, well, why did you lash out at them? Because they were only complimenting you. So that's the kind of, you know, lack of support that we have. And unfortunately, in the process of learning about this issue in general and researching it, I've met women who work in rape crisis centres who tell me, you know what, I'm not surprised, because the women who've been raped that come to us get the same type of response sometimes from the police. So whilst, yes, having a law against it won't necessarily stop it, if we have nothing, then these men who harassed me, for instance, you know, and seemed so shocked that I had fought back and, you know, it escalated into this violence, these men, they need to know that there's going to be a consequence. And also, some of them actually, yes, you're right, some of them are deliberately trying to kind of get a reaction, and they love the fact that it is kind of illicit and they shouldn't really be doing this. Some men surprisingly don't realise that following a girl home, asking her for your number the entire step of the way, isn't acceptable, because they know they're not going to, you know, rape me, but I don't know that they're not going to do that. And they just literally don't know, because the gap between women and men interacting in some places is so far. You know, we're so not on the same page. And I really want in schools for an education process to come in where we, you know, gender awareness in general, because there's something, you know, you see on the streets, you know, you've got boys sitting on one side of the road trying to impress the girl sitting on the other side of the road, and it's all, you know, law books very innocent, but what if they spend the rest of their lives always on the opposite side of the road and not actually understanding how to interact with each other? There's so many different things that can be done, and street harassment, I feel, is a symptom of obviously a very deep underlying issue, which is just the basic inequality of women and men in society, and the fact that we're not standing on the same levels at all.
Jess, I want to bring you in here because you've been listening very, very avidly to Kira and Vicky, and it seems to me that what you do in your writing and your own activism is bring out exactly this point, that there's a very fundamental gap in the way that society is engendered from a very, very, very young age, and that what you've got on your site is actually the result of it that happens, which kicks in with people's consciousness a little bit later on in their life. But do you feel that the kind of work you do actually affects change?
Yes, absolutely.
In what way?
It's certainly small steps, because it's such a massive problem, especially when you're talking about social attitudes and changes across the whole of the culture, which is something like tackling street harassment is on that scale. But you can affect people one at a time, and on something like the F word, where you can amplify those voices to, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of people, you do reach people, and we see that on a small scale in people writing to us and saying that something they've read has changed their attitude. Interestingly, on the street harassment thing, one piece that we ran a while back now was written by a man, and it was very interesting to me because he was saying that he didn't know, and his friends didn't, because they weren't directly participating in this harassment, they just thought that their interaction with women was how things were. And because women don't normally experience this, if there's a man walking with you, that's one of these little things where if you're walking along with a man, somehow, you know, you're insulated or you're protected, or you're not going to be harassed probably in the same way. And this fact that for a lot of men, they just don't know what's going on because they're not witness to it, and they're not perpetrating it as well. So, you know, it's things like this kind of awareness building, really, although it's a slow drip 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 thing, I think it does help over time to change attitudes.
What kind of issues are you particularly concerned about? It seems to me that although we talk about this being a current new wave of activism, which is certainly true, the fundamentals haven't changed.
No, the fundamental issues are basically the same, and they're the same issues that feminists were dealing with in the 70s and well before that, really. I mean, it's just the same issues of violence against women, discrimination, a culture which is kind of centering men's voices and men's issues and men's perspective on the world without even really realising it or consciously doing this. I don't know, I think it's the same issues. And what is changing now, in my opinion, is that there's been a gradual amplification of what is going on. And one, the awareness... I think that what happens is that new campaigns are being started, and those are encouraging other campaigns, and this is what is causing the wave. I don't think it's really in reaction to anything changing on the ground or anything changing in our culture. I think it's that people are being encouraged to see that other people are speaking out about it. Campaigns like Vicky's are going on, and you know, it's rolling into this momentum of for change, which is a fantastic thing.
I want to bring you up on one thing and bring Kira in here, because actually one of my contentions would be, having spoken to people over the last few weeks, that there is a perception, particularly amongst parents of young kids, that actually things are changing, but for the worst, in mainstream culture. And so there's that phrase, the sexualization of children, which is bandied about a lot, but it's also generally the kind of the glossification of images of women in the media. So now if you look at the obvious example is sort of glossy women's magazines, but at an event I was at in Bristol, someone analysed all the photographs of women athletes that were in The Observer and The Guardian, and what they showed was that there were 1,000 images of men and sort of just 19 or so of women. And not only that, but the men were shown being extremely admirable, so they were active, they were running, and the women were, you know, Paula Radcliffe cries by the side of the road with exhaustion, or they were women athletes who were just advertising something, or they were prettied up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that's interesting what you say about parents and about the sexualisation of children. I think that what we have seen over the past 10 years, and one way in which actually things have arguably become much worse, is that we've seen the rise of the sex industry. You know, for most of the past decade, although there has been a legal change on this recently, lap dancing clubs have been licensed in the same ways as cafes or bars, you know, so they could just set up anywhere. And they did set up anywhere and in enormous numbers. And that brought the sex industry to the high street. And what it showed was that there was actually a massive market for women's bodies to be sold to men, essentially, in that sort of high street setting. We've also seen in the past decade, obviously, an enormous rise in internet porn. We've seen a huge rise in the number of sort of men going for stag weekends in resorts which are well known for sex tourism and even in some cases sex trafficking. So I think that has all become very, very normalised, and that obviously filters down to the way in which children perceive the world and the way in which things are sold to children. So, you know, T-shirts which have sort of provocative slogans on being sold to two-year-olds. I mean, what you also see with children, which I think has been really, really apparent over the past decade, and which is really troubling, and which Natasha Walter writes about a lot in her book Living Dolls, which was published last year, is the sort of polarisation of boys and girls. So you walk into a toy shop, and where once you would just have seen a toy shop and there would have been boats and trains and dolls, and it would have been a general, you know, kind of Aladdin's cave of toys. Now you walk in, and often there is almost as if a line has been drawn down in the middle.
There's the blue floor and the pink floor, as someone described to me at Hamleys.
Yeah. I mean, just astonishing. And, you know, so I think we always like to think that we're going in one direction, and that direction is progress. And you know, for instance, children are less bound by gender roles. But I think the movement, and it's been a consumerist and capitalist movement of the last 10 years, has really been towards the polarisation of boys and girls as a way of selling things. You know, it's much easier to sell something that's very pink or very blue to a specific market than it is to sell, you know, the blue and white and green stripe boat to children in general.
But what exactly happened? This is what I find very puzzling, that there was a prior and extremely strong wave of activism, which I had sort of naively thought would bring this new generation of extremely enlightened parents into the world, who would bring up girls who respect themselves and boys who respect themselves and constantly consequently respect girls as well. And instead, some forces seem to have come in from the outside. And we call it pornification, we call it the capitalisation of kids' toys, we call it all sorts of things. But how is it that we have been so blindsided by this that we couldn't see it happening? What do you think are the factors behind it, Jess? I mean, part of it obviously is the fact that there's a free internet, that you used to have to be able to make a bit of an effort to get your porn, and now you don't really have to make any effort at all.
I think that it probably comes down to the fact that although the second wave of activism that happened in the 70s was amazing, it changed lots of things, it was an amazing achievement, things did change because of it, it didn't change enough to really create the shift that was needed, and that has meant that as we have things like the internet and the technology has changed, then it's just reflecting the social norms of the culture. So that's really what's happened, in my opinion. And you know, the acceptability of things like porn in the mainstream is, you know, it's really couldn't have happened if there had been a more significant shift, I think, anyway. But it's hard to know, isn't it? Because in the 70s they were dealing with such a huge change, like we are now. It's massive. It's a really massive problem that you have to just chip away at slowly. But I would just say as well that I think that we can't over... I don't know, we have to be a bit careful about this narrative that things are definitely getting worse. Because although it's definitely true, I've been to Hamleys with my cousins, I've seen the pink floor and the blue floor, but I kind of remember a little bit of that when I was a kid as well. I don't think it's changed. It's not like we had a utopia of
unisex after the 70s. Toys.
Yeah, I think that it has got worse, and I think it's linked to really consumerism and very aggressive selling tactics. But you know, we have to be a bit like, it's not just gone completely.
Oh yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say in general that progress has not been made, but I just think there are areas in which kind of consumer capitalism has triumphed, really.
Do you think there's a kind of cultural background behind it as well? One of the other things that Natasha Walter mentions in her book is that these days, if you're a kid and you're watching a cartoon, there are almost no young people's narratives in which there's a really cool girl in the leading role, or in fact in any role at all, that she does this sort of very devastating to read numerical breakdown and shows that sort of 88% of heroes/heroines are boys, and all the sidekicks are boy and man characters, and they're brilliant characters. If you were a girl, you'd watch it, but then that just results in girls thinking that boys get the really good times, and that sort of girl characters are basically like Minnie Mouse, which is the which is the boy in drag. It's the one with the high voice who's ridiculous, who doesn't get any good lines, doesn't get any adventures or anything.
I remember watching actually the film, I guess it was last year, Kick-Ass.
Yes.
Which, you know, there have been lots of critiques made of that film, and obviously it stars Aaron Johnson as a boy who's trying to be a superhero, but it also stars a young woman who's 12,
Chloe Moretz,
as a girl who is, you know, this incredible kind of superhero, and she's led by her father, so you could see it as a real kind of patriarchal narrative. But as I was watching it, and I was there with my stepson, and we were, you know, we enjoyed it. It's incredibly violent, but
that's part of the joy.
So there are many ways in which I'm sure if I was called to defend it, I could not defend it. Anyway, I was watching it, and I was watching it with this kind of surge of excitement excitement at what I was seeing on screen, and I kind of couldn't put my finger on it immediately. And then I realised that it was one of the first times I had ever seen a young female character who was not sexualised in a position of extreme power. You know, she is a character who absolutely takes down every enemy who comes at her. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, this is how boys feel all the time. You know, I thought, wow, this is how it feels to be a boy. You know, because you just don't have that experience.
And that what we tend to do as women viewers is actually we project our appreciation onto the male characters who are there, who are nuanced and active and have adventures to do. And we're so used to it. I mean, I remember watching Dark Knight, which, spoiler alert, everyone, the woman in Dark Knight dies. I'm sorry. There are no women characters at all, apart from this Rachel Dawes, who just gets killed in a sort of accidental, joking way. And I remember being really excited and really loving the film because of what I'd done, of course, was identify with the good guy and the bad guy and everyone else who is in it. But there were no women characters in that film. And that's true, unfortunately, of, I think, all Christopher Nolan films. You know, each one has the token woman in it. But before we get on to Film Critique International, which we'll do later, I want to bring you, Vicky, back into this. We've been talking today about activism and change, and we're all, this day being so important, in the middle of numerous commitments which are all to do with International Women's Day. But something that bothers me, of course, is that these are huge issues, and yet somehow we are all running around because all the events have been slotted into the same 5-day time frame. Why is it that the mainstreaming of these issues hasn't happened? Because actually, if you look at something really serious like domestic violence, 90% of domestic violence incidents are witnessed by kids of both sexes. So it's not like this is a secret women have been keeping from the world. This affects everybody. And I mean, my argument is always that this kind of culture destroys women and destroys men and destroys girls and destroys boys, because this is hardly the kind of society we want to co-create.
So you asked me, why is it not mainstream, this general kind of activism?
Yeah, why is it that we are already exhausted? Because this is probably our third or fourth appointment of the day, talking about these things which really should be talked about all the time.
In mainstream culture. I think it's a little bit like being plugged into the Matrix. We've just been talking about
I like the fact this is going.
I'm a sci-fi freak. You really started me on the wrong thing. But look, we're all plugged into this idea of what reality is and what's normal and what's normal for men and women. And a lot of my friends are just completely turned off the minute I start any of my feminist ranting, as they like to think of it. Because they're, you know, it's not fun. What's fun is watching, you know, kick arse and, you know, all of this, you know, all of this commercial stuff that's just pumped our way all the time. And it's fun to read girls' magazines, and it's fun to kind of not challenge the status quo and just go along with things and just, you know, sit back and enjoy the ride. And unless you feel that you've been directly wronged, and a lot of women don't really even realise that they have been wronged, you know, it's just so much effort and it's so tiring. I find it tiring sometimes, but I am a bit, you know, of a mouthy ginger Irish girl that kind of can't shut up about my problems. It can be tiring.
I like,
just
you
easier.
Just did a classic feminine mystique thing there, which is just put yourself down, lady.
But I'm in the Matrix still, and that's it. Like, it's really hard to unplug, and you there's so many different things, like, all the time. The fact that you grow up watching, you know, female passive role models in TV and active male ones, and all this is just constantly kind of, you internalise it, and it's really, really hard to plug yourself out and actually take an objective look. And lots of people just don't even want to have to go to the effort, and they feel like they're being nagged, I guess, as well. And that makes people like me feel like I have to be the positive, happy face of feminism. You know, I can't get angry because that's just going to turn people off. It's not entertaining and fun. But I think that actually there's loads of things that we can do that aren't all about being, you know, these angry feminists, and some things that we need to be angry about still.
Jess, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to mix up the messages, and this is what we try and do on the F Word as well, because you have to obviously tackle, and it's really important to tackle these really serious issues like domestic violence, violence against women in general, very high priority. But also we need to be kind of looking for how we're creating the world that we want to see, and doing things like cultural activism can be really important in that. And some of it is having a fun discussion about a film like Kick-Ass or something like that. And some of it is things like Ladyfest, which is this festival which has been going on, again, for about 10 years, I think, which is all about celebrating art and music and film by women, or predominantly by women. And we've got Bird's Eye View Film Festival starting tonight as well, I think. And that is a film festival which is showing films by female filmmakers. And this is really important because then to stop you just getting burnt out and exhausted and to stop people turning off all the time as soon as you start talking about feminism, you do have to do these positive things as well to, yeah, like I said, to create the world that we want and not just be constantly just desperately trying to chip away at these really negative issues.
Do you think it's also a question, as Vicky implied, of despair, that sometimes it's really very comfortable being in the matrix, in the world of illusions, in the sort of falsely created culture, because actually once you have your consciousness raised, consolation is a little bit thin on the ground. So you learn all these things about the experiences of other women, particularly other women globally, and the news is often not good.
Yes, yes. And it can be difficult. You can't really turn it off. Once you've got your feminist switch turned on, it's actually very difficult to turn it off and just enjoy yourself going to the movies or whatever. But you can't just bury your head in the sand. This is the reality. And our problems, you know, as you said, the situation globally is really, really dire. And the problems of women in this country and the problems of the women around the world they're experiencing are really grim, and we need to actually tackle them. We can't just ignore them and pretend they're not. It's not happening.
Kira, I want to bring you in here because the question of despair must be quite hard for someone who's in a position like yours, which is that you have edited pages and you get to choose what's in them. But I'm assuming that every single day you get hundreds of emails from interested parties, from women's groups about issues across a range of topics. How do you balance all of these things in a way that is a pleasure and useful and helpful for readers?
Yes, it was very difficult when I was women's editor because you would get something like 1,000 pitches a week for one or two features that we would run in the pages. So on the one hand, that's a really, really positive thing because it underlines just how many people are engaged with these issues and want to write about them. But on the other hand, it shows how overwhelming it is to be in that position. My view always with the women's pages, and my view now as a writer who often will be writing about feminist issues, is that it's important to have a mix of material. So on the one hand, I think we should be angry. I think there's every reason to be angry, and I think it's very, very important to run pieces which really express that anger in the most direct and the most expressive and the most serious terms possible. However, I also think that the idea that women's lives are just one hellish sort of drudging journey,
an endless round of oppression
is horrendous and should be resisted.
And is also not true.
Exactly. So you have to be realistic about it. And I think it's important to run things which highlight the positive things that are happening and the brilliant work that people are doing, you know, that women are doing culturally, the brilliant activism. I mean, that was what was great about being women's editor, was that I could cover some of the activism that was going on around the country, which was enormous. You know, in those 5 years, the amount of campaigning that was taking place, a lot of it very successful. I mean, just before I started actually in that job, Object, the campaigning group, started their campaign to see lads mags that have explicit covers put onto the top shelf of places like Sainsbury's, Tesco, and that actually came to fruition last week. They won that campaign, and you just think, you know, that 5 year time span is such a tribute to the dedication and the determination of those women. And so that was what was really exciting, was that you could actually highlight all that kind of really positive, exciting and creative work that was going on around the country.
We should point out that while Object have absolutely triumphed, W.H. Yeah. Smith still refused to put porn mags any higher than what they call sort of its
own. Oh, yes.
It's a metre 20, which is the yeah. height of the average 7-year-old boy, which I think is quite funny, unfortunately. No, it's not funny. It's very, very serious. Actually, it's a very serious issue. But I love that the press release pointed out that, you know, roughly the height of a 12-year-old or 7-year-old child. Something you pointed out, though, is that Object were campaigning for 5 years, yeah. which is actually a long time. And if I can put that to Vicky, since you're actively campaigning, are you ever frustrated by the time it takes to change attitudes in a very deep way?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a very frustrated woman in general, I think, these days. But frustrated and inspired, because you never quite know what reaction you're going to get. So last year I went to an event that was actually hosted by Hollaback London, which are another street harassment campaigning group, and they're more about the grassroots kind of women themselves who've been harassed posting stories about their experiences. Anyway, I went to this event and spoke, and there's quite a lot of guys there, and they were looking at each other, and when they, you know, came to commenting, they're putting up their hands saying, "We didn't know this happened. We're shocked." And they really wanted to get on board. And I was actually really pleasantly surprised, because that isn't always the reaction I get. Sometimes I get really aggressive reactions from guys who just feel like, "Oh, yeah, we're men again. Yeah, I'm sorry that I've got a penis and you're just going to campaign against my general existence." And a lot of men think that that's kind of what, you know, "Well, I didn't do anything wrong. Why are you targeting me?" And you get quite a lot of oppression you're putting it out there, especially when it's online, putting it out into the world, and you have to be open to any kind of reaction you get back. And when it is online and kind of anonymous, you can get really aggressive, kind of frustrating responses. And actually today I went onto my Lash Campaign's Facebook page and to be greeted with a whole list of misogynistic spam. Loads of guys had written some what they called, obviously thought were jokes about women want to be harassed, women like it. You know, I'd only ask permission if she was hot, otherwise I'd probably just do her anyway and then pass her around my mates, and all of this kind of really horrible misogynistic stuff, which they clearly thought was hilarious. And because they were hiding behind little, you know, avatars, they thought they could just post this kind of stuff. I've actually reported them to the police, so good luck to them. But you face that just by putting yourself out there and trying to put a name to things. You do face actual persecution, and that's what can get really, really frustrating.
This question of online reaction is something that we've spoken about amongst ourselves many, many times, because now all of culture, including newspapers, which do have hard copy versions, are also digitized. And unfortunately, it seems to be absolutely endemic on the internet that as soon as anyone at all can post under a pseudonymous username, that the abuse is incredible. I mean, the misogynistic abuse on certain newspaper websites is notorious, as is racist and homophobic, Islamophobic and anti-Semitic abuse. So basically all the flashpoints of culture are what attracts these people. Jess, since the F word is online, how do you mitigate against this sort of it's basically harassment, isn't it? It's not as though these people actually engage in the debate. It's abuse.
Well, we privilege having a safer space over allowing anyone to comment and say anything they want.
What do you mean by that? I mean,
really, it's about, in practical terms, what that means is that on our blog, we have probably one of the stricter moderation policies of a UK political blog. And it's surprising to say that, but all that means is that we don't allow sexist, racist, homophobic comments and other kinds of offensive comments on the blog, which you would think wasn't a radical position, but actually is, really, when it comes to not just newspaper websites, but other political websites. It's completely standard now to see these kind of comments, but we just think there should be a space where you can go and not have to deal with that. So that's how we do it. It's a burden on the editors and the writers on the site, because we still have to see it, but for the reader at least, then you hopefully have somewhere you can go and just not even think about that.
Do you get much abuse? So you say that you read through everything that's posted and then you decide whether it's on or not. I would have thought that since the F word is so well established now, that has tailed off. Is that not the case?
No, not really. Some people get bored and go away. Some people don't, even though they're just talking to us, basically, and their stuff never gets published. Maybe they never come back and check. I don't know. Some of it's really ridiculous. It's so extreme that we can just laugh about it because we're used to it. But the difficulty is really when you're just starting out or you're not used to it, then it can seem very, very intimidating to have these extremely misogynistic comments on anything you write. So just especially because the F word runs a lot of pieces by people who are not professional writers, they're not journalists, it's perhaps the first thing they've written for publication ever. And, you know, or they're very young. We've had like a 9-year-old girl writing. We have people who just are not confident. And so it's really important to us as a political statement, really, that you're not bombarded with sexist comments, like, you know, just for stepping forward and saying what you think.
Kira, I'll bring you in here because we've both written for The Guardian, and as seasoned hacks, we are very inured against it. You don't have to, but you are made to grow an extremely thick skin about this kind of thing. I'm never bothered by comments anymore because I regard them as being very indicative of exactly the kind of harassment that I'm often writing about, and I like them to remain at the bottom of the article because it's so obvious that often the comments are wildly out of proportion to what you've written about.
No, they absolutely underline why you're making the argument in the first place. I've had so many threats of gang rape, murder over the years. I mean, it's just...
Was there the one where you were going to be cut into pieces?
Yes, and put in a bucket.
Yes.
But
I love that additional detail.
Oh, there was so much detail. Really, I mean, these people should have been writing novels.
Or running a small provincial nursery.
My favourite
a nursery for plants, obviously, not children.
My favourite comment ever, actually, and I it really makes me kick myself because I can't remember which article it was on, but it was someone who was saying, and it was just one line, and it said something like, "Well, this signals the very end of the women's movement." And then I looked up to the name, and this, you know, this absolutely savage indictment of my piece had been made by someone who termed themselves Monkey Spunk Moped. And I thought, well, you know, that's okay.
Fair dues. Yeah, really. Fair dues. Someone who goes through life named that. It's not going to flourish. I feel that
not
was not
really.
A flourishing
you could understand
individual.
Why he was angry. It can still be depressing sometimes. I think sometimes when it's on an article that you're not expecting to get particularly savage misogynist comments on, and they suddenly arrive out of the blue, that's when it can slightly sort of take you aback. But no, at this stage, I think everything that could possibly have been sent to me or said to me has been. So
on the upside, I have to confess that we've been talking here about activism and change, and part of the current wave of activism is that so many, particularly young women, are saying, okay, the internet has opened up these means for us to organise and to disseminate information. And I'm very sceptical about it because sometimes I feel that if you post an example of harassment with a picture of the harasser up on Hollaback, which is the harassment site which is global, you feel better yourself, Vicky, but you haven't done things like go to the police. You haven't done things like go to politicians. You've sort of... And you haven't really shamed the perpetrator because it's not like they're going to check on Hollaback to see if they've been ranked as the harasser of the week. You've just sort of exorcised your sense of chagrin at it.
I think that... I don't know that online activism has a really important place because those sites, you're right, there's certain things that that person may or may not have done in real life, as it were. They may not have told off their harasser, they may not have gone to the police, but they feel like they've got a community to go to, a bit like the F word. It's somewhere that you go, share how you feel, and get responses of support, but also because it is public, it means that people that want to find out about street harassment, for instance, these guys that say, what, street harassment? What's that? I've never heard of it before. They've got somewhere to go and learn, well, what's actually happening. And if I want a journalist to write about my campaign and they want a case study, I can direct them to Holla Back and say, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories to choose from. Go and have a look. And also, it's just an arena, it's access to something. So ideas that, you know, people previously perhaps felt that they were alone in, they can suddenly go out and see actually on the web, there are people all over the world that share these ideas and helps you develop your ideas further as well. I've learned a lot from just reading blogs and finding out about other campaigners, and I felt very inspired, you know, listening to reading about the success stories of other campaigns, and I can put in my, you know, tuppence worth and show my support for them as well, all on that online arena. And in this day and age, actually, that does translate into real world actions. I mean, a lot of the things that are happening today, like today I went to the Women on the Bridge event where, you know, hundreds of women, thousands of women around the world are standing on bridges. So I went and stood on Millennium Bridge.
And this was actually led by Annie Lennox. Yeah. It was Borough to Millennium Bridge. Yeah.
So I went down there. That was all organised, you know, online, using, you know, Facebook event pages and, you know, newsletters and things like that. It's actually quite amazing what it can translate into. It can translate into action, but I guess you need to have that little bit of extra drive and impetus. You know, you can't just leave it online. You need to kind of internalise it and take it out there as well.
And it always comes back to the same thing, doesn't it, which is that we need collective action. And that's what frightens me about internet activism, which is that it's still about individual women alone contributing to these things. And, you know, what I'm in favour of is the march and the kind of huge public events. What more would you like to see happen? I absolutely love, and one of the things I admire about your campaign is that you've taken it to politicians, but you also mentioned the police and their unsympathetic response. One of the things I always say to women is always go to the police, even if you think it's trivial, because even if they don't believe you, frankly, they have an obligation to take a statement, and who knows, if one of the perpetrators does something more serious, at least their description, you know, your description of where they are and what they said might chime with a more serious case. You know, you're always helping another woman, but it's hard to confront a body which has traditionally been seen as unsympathetic.
Well, I've felt that frustration and that feeling that you're just too tiny to do anything about it, but actually the police have a obligation to act upon reported crimes, and you can actually report hate speech. You can go onto the police's website and report incidents of hate speech against you as a minority, and being a woman is, you know, gender-based hate speech. If enough women did that every time they're harassed, which is, you know, thousands of instances a day, you know, nationally, then it would become a statistic, and that's what the police really respond to, statistics. So if they, you know, hear that, you know, or you're, you know, today you're going to have to start rolling out this plan in this borough and this borough and this borough because there's a statistic, then they're going to do something. But it's actually enabling women and making them feel that you can do something. You need to report it to somebody somewhere to actually give it a statistic and then give yourself a voice, because if we keep silent, then nothing can happen.
Jess, what would you like to see happen? The F word is currently in the middle of a sort of grand campaign, and you're expanding and zhuzhing yourselves up a little bit, I think. And you've already raised it's into the thousands already, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We're basically right at the end of our fundraising campaign. We fundraised for £3,000 to do a professional redesign of the site. As it is our 10th birthday, we thought we deserved it, and that's going to launch
buy yourself
very
something
shortly.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so I don't know. I think that, of course, we are an online site. So, and also as a journalist, I think that there's a lot of power in that kind of, it is media work, media activism, really. But it all contributes. And I think that, what I would like to see our site do is just get bigger and bigger and more successful, of course. Of course, I would say that. Really have many more contributors. So if you were listening to this and you were wondering about if you wanted to write for us, then please do email in your ideas. I think that what happens online really does build up into things offline. I mean, we had the Million Women Rise March this weekend, and
the organisers say that 10,000 women marched, and that's up on 8,000 last year and 5,000 the year before that, which I think was the first one. And so you can see that it's growing. You know, your traditional on the streets kind of campaigns are growing, and I think they are actually being supported by those ideas that are being amplified online, and people just even finding out that this is happening. Whereas you, rather than just having to see a flyer or sign up somewhere and getting a Facebook invite or whatever it is, does, or a Twitter invite, does actually encourage people to come along.
It's interesting that you mentioned Million Women Rise, because actually that was an event which was very sort of top line in the women's movement, but was then shelved for a while and then resurrected. And I do see it as a sign of the resurrection of women's feeling about this politically generally. I don't think that women have ever felt any differently, but I think that there's come a point at which, you know, the sentiment has tipped over into what Vicky and Jess have been saying, which is actual action and not just this internalised sense of disturbance.
Absolutely. And I think what's exciting at the moment is that there is momentum, and I think it is possible that that will be built upon. I think there's an International Women's Day website, and it lists the number of events by country. And it was really interesting to see that the UK had hundreds more events, even than the countries which were next on the list, which were kind of Canada and the USA. We had almost more than double, I think, the events that those countries were hosting. And I think what that speaks to is a much wider activism that's going on throughout the year. I agree that it's quite frustrating in a way that you have 450 events in the space of a week or so,
and all double booked. I mean,
all double booked. You know, there's no way of getting to them all, obviously, and that is a little bit frustrating. But I think it speaks to the fact that there's so much going on that, you know, if a restaurant like Hooters, which serves up massive cleavage along with its burgers, decides that it wants to open in the UK, it's a US chain. You know, that feminists all around the country will organise to make sure that that doesn't happen. There's so much going on, you know, the marches, Reclaim the Night, Million Women Rise, that I really think that as long as that can keep going, this really could lead somewhere exciting. And I think, you know, we have also, talking about online activism, something like UK Feminista, which is a hub for women's groups in the UK. And I think even just having that hub, having somewhere that people can get together to hear about different groups and to join them and to start them themselves and advertise them, that, you know, really encourages people to get involved. So I do think it's a time to kind of feel excited, and to get working. You know, we've seen a massive rise in feminist publishing over the last year. There were about 8 books, feminist books, published last year after an absolute dearth of British feminist publishing. So, you know, I think what's important is for British feminists to keep that momentum going and to really feel positive and that this might actually lead to genuine major social change.
I want to end with Jess on this note of feminist publishing, because I think that's absolutely true. I was interviewing a publisher once about 10 years ago, and she said, you know why non-fiction publishing has failed? It's because the bottom dropped out of publishing on gender completely. And of course that has been completely overturned. We've got Living Dolls, the return of sexism, I think it's called. We've got One Dimensional Woman, we've got an amazing book called Delusions of Gender by Cordelia Fine, which is an excellent sort of debunking of pseudoscientific sexism. Do you think this is one of the sort of core elements of this resurgence of activism, that actually what we're doing in all of these articles and books is we're leaving behind us a huge body of work?
Yes, yeah, definitely. And these books reach out to new people, new audiences, and especially, you know, the Delusions of Gender book created a lot of discussion in the media and in general about issues that are just not discussed. And that's what it starts off a conversation. Each of these books starts off a conversation, feeds into each other. It just rolls up into more and more activism and more people getting inspired and feeling like, yes, I can go and do something. That's, you know, that's a wonderful outcome.
On that note, I'm going to say thank you very much, Jess McCabe, Kira Cochrane and Vicky Simister. I've been Badisha, and happy International Women's Day.